This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I thought I might just begin by calling your attention to a few moments in the show, which some of you may have also encountered, those of you who have been through the show, that to me speak to this very significant auscultation of the cost of gold that Roz and her collaborators, Bekani, Jaman, and Prosper and Kube have brought to the fore. And one of these, or the first one, is actually, I think, on this video right here, which opens with the woman asking, "Shall I just start the interview, or should I say hello first?" Later in other pieces here, someone says, "You really need to tell the story clearly and properly." So I want to sort of draw our attention to this clear address, an address that seems to come out of these video screens, and we can think a little bit about who and to whom these are addressed. Another one is whether this project, someone says at a certain point, is this project real? And that people assure them saying, yes, of course, white people are involved. And therefore you know that this project has a kind of validity. Bekani and his wife Sarah say at some point, what do you want as a future for your child? What would you want your daughter to study? And they say, we would like her to do whatever her heart desires. We'd like a future for her that she may want to shape and do. And then there is the kind of way in which English seems to seep out of the translations, and English comes through in words like dust, knocking, crushing, clinic, hospital, ambulance, treatment. So I'm thinking of where is it that English, and therefore a kind of world of the industrial world, seems to seep in to the vocabularies. Where is it that erupts in the language and seems to find its way forward? I think it might be called a below ground above too. And it's a silent video, and it has men working underground, women crushing, and somewhere in the middle, an extraordinary scene of people slathering butter onto bits of bread and putting onto the butter what in another video we learn is sleepy peanut butter, the kind of butter that makes you feel a bit sleepy underground. But it's a moment of a sort of strange glistening excess amid what seems to be extremely bleak and desolate and dark environment. So auscultation is a term, or at least the stethoscope is an image that Roz herself, I think, in one of the texts, invokes. So I'm thinking of what does it mean to think about auscultation as a way of understanding the Zama Zama project, right? What does it mean to think of this as a project of Roz and her collaborators putting a stethoscope to the earth to, in a sense, hear the cost of gold? One thing that the stethoscope does is it has no print. You know, it's not like an X-ray. There's nothing else that comes out of it that allows you to see it. You really do have to rely on the evidence of your ears. It's the responsibility of the listener. It's the responsibility of the person who hears to determine what it is that they're hearing. Hearing is a capacious sense. You know, it allows for a lot of ambiguity. It allows us to tolerate things that don't have a bounded, that are not bounded, that seem to exceed, that seem to dissipate. But it's also a risky, dangerous sense. We can get distracted. It's an impatient sense. We overhear, but then we dismiss it. So how do we then, taking auscultation as a form, try to think about this project in the ruins of a kind of industrial technology of mining, where the shiny properties of gold and the shiny properties of spirit, of the spirit of these men and women, seem to find their way through? Is that a Dare I say that? Is that a risky thing to say? Is that a facile observation to sort of find something extraordinary in the spirit of these people, in the way in which they demand and they address, and they seem to be the sound that comes through the stethoscope back in my ear here? Because there's definitely an address, that we are being addressed. But who is being addressed is sometimes not altogether clear. Us in Philadelphia, each other through WhatsApp, because they talk about sharing these videos on WhatsApp. They're very aware of the world in which they must circulate. So in some ways, I'm coming back to you, Roz, to try to understand how you see this project, which I know is something you've been engaged with, not only with these collaborators, but in this site and in this location for close on 20 years, I think, more, 25 years. What does it mean to hear? Is it a practice of hearing, or what does it mean to commit yourself to that? And where does this manifestation of that project exist in how you understand your whole sort of dedicated work?
Thank you, Rads. I was so pleased when Rads agreed to join me in conversation this evening, because we have known each other for more than 25 years and have spoken over this time about my predilections and hers, and thought about these questions about what it means to engage others in their own aspirations to become visible to us and other things. So these are incredibly beautiful and opening questions. If I could just take a moment to pause and thank Aaron Levy and Eduardo Cadava for inviting me to share this work with you in this beautiful space. And thank you for coming, in addition to thanking Rads for joining us. It's an enormously gratifying opportunity for me, both because this work that I have been obsessed with for many, many years now has a place in which to reach others, but also because I know very much that the people who are speaking to you directly and indirectly in these works long to be heard and seen by you. And they've been named already, but I will name them again. Rogers Bekani Mumpande, Prosper Nkuba, Darren Munenge, Sarah Muchimba. These are people with whom I've traveled with this project, and so I've been speaking about them a lot on WhatsApp. I was never a social media person until a few years ago, when this project demanded that I find a way to be available and responsive. But you've asked me some very important questions, so I'll try and answer them in ways that might help us move towards a collective conversation. And the first set of questions I think that perhaps need to be addressed are what it is to have an exhibition of this sort. What is the nature of the address that is being ventriloquized or enabled or perhaps directed by myself? And what is the nature of this aspiration to be visible or to obtain recognition on the part of these people? And what's the relationship to my own work? I have, as Rads has said, have worked in and around the deep industrial gold mines of South Africa for more than 20 years. I am the child of a geologist. I am the granddaughter of an underground miner. So there are many complicated biographical elements that may or may not be worthy of discussion here. But in this more than 20 years, that world has been radically transformed. From the site of the deepest, most productive gold mines, which were, even at the point when I arrived, no longer the centers of the economy in South Africa, but they were the imaginative centers of the historical self-consciousness of that national space, but also that extra-national space, the destination of migrants, the dream object of migrants, and the defensively protected space of nationalists who had once been migrants, in that difficult moment of transition from the apartheid space into the post-apartheid democratic era. That world, nonetheless, is not the world that you are seeing displayed, discussed in this project. In that very short period of 20 years, which for me, of course, is a very long period, for some of these young people is almost a lifetime, and alas, for some of these young people is a lifetime, because they don't all survive this. But in that time, this industrial economy has reached its apex and moved into its fairly radical descent. By 2033, all of the industrial gold mines of South Africa will be exhausted using conventional methods. So we have gone from a moment in which people's imaginations were those of an open and almost infinite horizon of wealth and opportunity, to a space of contestation over the contraction of those opportunities, to the space of ruin that you see here. Eduardo has asked me, you know, what is it about these ruins that are more than themselves that let us think about this moment economically? And I said to him, you know, there's a moment in Walter Benjamin's writings that appear in the Arcades Project where Benjamin says, you know, the thing about industrial capitalism is not only that it generates value through industrial and rational productions, but that it makes waste a source of value. And that the figure of industrial capitalism is as much the rag picker as the worker on the assembly line. And in this world, you see the consequences of this rationalization and industrialization of mining. These mines go 2, 3, 4 kilometers deep. They're the deepest mines in the world. They are in everywhere, the accomplishment of industry. And so the afterlives of this ruination, mining is always ruinous, but this is ruination. The afterlives of this ruination are ones in which it looks often like a return to the artisanal, to the pre-industrial. And I want to say it's not. Because unlike in those worlds where alluvial mining was the case, these people live in spaces, work in spaces, inhabit the contaminated environments that can only be understood in terms of the history of industry. So if you grind rock on a smooth cement space, that smooth cement is the presence of industry. If you go down to 3 kilometers under the earth in order to find gold in these mad, terrifying ways, this is because those worlds were opened up by industry. This is not merely the artisanal, it is the post-industrial. It's what I've tried to say. This is remanualization. And I think a lot of us here think of the post-industrial in terms of its freedoms, its emancipations from both manual and mechanical life. And I want people to grasp the cost of deindustrialization in those spaces where the profits of industrialization are not distributed in ways that let people access deindustrialization as freedom, where it is re-manualization. In this exhibition, there are works that are projected. There are more fragmentary narrative documents that are playing on the monitors. There are frame exports from videos. These are not photographs. I want them to be understood as exports from the videos, which have their formal properties, which are extremely grand thumbnails. But that is, they're edited, they're considered, because everything here is in some ways responded to, grasped, taken from the flow of life. I want people to understand these as not enframed in the way that photographic representation can pause things. And yet, of course, there are these pauses, these poses, these addresses, as you say, should I say hello? I mean, I wanted very much for you to see those moments, the self-consciousness of the address. 4 years ago, when I first went to this area, after having met and done some life historical work with other Zama-Zamas, as they're called, I went to this area and introduced myself, and it was very much the aspiration of the young men whom I first met to tell me, show me, make available an image of themselves, you could say pose themselves for me and you, therefore. They wanted to be seen. And this is rhetorically saturates all the languages. Rogers Bekani Mompande has named himself Bekani. Bekani means look at that. This is, you see, you would hear in these languages all this look, 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 you know, to be seen in the documentary film that is adjacent to this project. He indeed speaks about his desire to be one of those people about whom others will say, hey, look at that man. He's someone to look at. Okay, so some of that is young men everywhere in the social media world. Everyone wants to be seen and known. You know, I mean, there's no reason that they are anything other than young people here. Some of it is the acclaim upon political recognition in a space where they are denied rights as citizens, as people who have any claim upon protections from the police, or who cannot access health and other resources. Some of it is a specific claim on me and my substituting for you, a desire to be seen by me, to be the kind of person who would be listened to by me, just as I desire to be the kind of person who asks for them, such that they would be the kind of people who would say, I want you to listen. This is the complicated psychoanalytic dynamics of transference in an anthropological context, yeah? But also, some of it is the desperate opposition to the incredibly violent xenophobia that now is directed towards these migrants, who the whole industry of mining required to move to and from industrial spaces. You know, these people now are disavowed by those who, by virtue of the violence of colonialism, are divided by nation-state boundaries, yeah? And in South Africa these days, there is great suspicion, anger, and hostility towards Zama-Zamas, a great misunderstanding. So our collective project is partly to, I suppose, try and make a claim on people's ears and minds that would allow them to think of these people as something other than thieving, murderous, rapacious, violent usurpers, brigands of the democratic space in South Africa. So that's part of it. And I'll say one last thing, and then you can drag me back to the... Sorry, I do tend to go on a bit. Translation. Now, you mentioned all the ways in which English is entered into what is subtitled here or heard in all these words, clinic, dust, and so forth. But also, if you will notice, every reference to number. So the kind of history of abstraction, the history of rents, the history of, alas, of the history of becoming paper, the agonizing desire to be documented, because that's the only way to enter into the space of recognition. All of that is spoken in either a lexicalized version of English or in English. There are many languages spoken in these underground. People never know what languages they will encounter, so people tend to work and live together in language-specific groups. The three men with whom I work most closely come from northern Zimbabwe, Minga area. They speak Chitonga. Underground, they don't know because there's no light. You don't see who you will encounter. Are they, you know? So one starts off in one language and slides down a chain of other languages, and every sentence might be full of four languages. And sometimes those languages are very strongly overlaid, and so you don't need to separate. And sometimes they're full of fuzami, and it's a disaster. And sometimes the wit that is very much valorized is the wit that comes from playing across languages. And sometimes you can insult each other in a language you know that person doesn't know, and you can say, as Bekani says, I could kill you with words and you wouldn't even know it. And sometimes it is the source of danger because you need to communicate underground. Things may happen. There are never formations of what one would call a lingua franca, because these are transient worlds. People come and go and come and go. It would be a different group of people speaking at any given time. So in these films you have Isindebele, Isizulu, Chitonga, Sesotho, English, Afrikaans, a little Shona at some point. I don't speak all those languages. And sometimes I understand and sometimes I don't. And when the young men filmed underground and brought up their work, we had to translate it after the fact. I was present for one trip, but not for the majority of the time underground. That took over a year. And happily, I live in New York City, where there are people who speak all sorts of languages. And we assembled a group with rural Sesotho, northern Zimbabwe and Tintonga, Ndebele isiZulu, to work through this project. My translational strategies were to stick very close to the literal idiom because they are so attentive themselves to this. And now I should be quiet. Or as one says,
well, let me... Edward, were you going to pop in? Yeah, come in.
Before we leave the question of language and translation, can you say something about something that I register, which is that they rarely seem to use the word for gold. They always seem to be referencing money and not gold. So they'll be with the pans looking, and they're saying, oh, here's the money, or there's no money here, and they're looking for little traces of gold. Can you say something about that translation?
So indeed, people almost never speak of gold except when they are speaking in English or when they know I'm listening. Otherwise, the word that is used is imali, which is covers all of the languages of Southern Africa and can be mean just value or money or that which is convertible. And they speak about the gold, what we would call gold, when it's in the rock, when it's still in the quartz, not yet even chipped out, as imali. They speak of what's being sluiced as imali. They speak of what's being amalgamated as imali. They speak of, at every stage of the process, this is imali. And this tells you something about how completely that world is suffused by this commodity logic that has rendered this industry possible, necessary, and the only means of hard currency. It can be used to cancel debt. It can, you know, it is a totally convertible.
It's taking the luster of gold away from gold in a certain way, right? I mean, it also takes away the what we think elsewhere as, oh, a gold. You know, I remember as a kid saying it's golden. I don't know. We never say golden after we're children. Somehow we learn to grow up and drop the en. But when I was a kid, something important was she has golden hair, it has golden things. So that kind of quality of luster seems to me is evacuated in understanding it as a convertible, right? Then it doesn't have a aura of its own, a luster of its own, right?
Or I mean, I would say yes, and yet if you see at the end, there's an image of a woman wearing a gold ring. And there, who's grinding and nonetheless wearing a gold ring. And you'll see there's a man who's got four pseudo gold rings. And so there is something also of that, but in terms of its production, it is simply the object of the call to a labor that is in some kind of strange calculus of time, you know. You will stay underground long enough to get, but it's not a kind of wage economy. But yes, you're absolutely right. There's no metaphoric value that comes to gold in that way.
Well, I actually want to go back to maybe just a little bit to the idea of the document, which is they're chasing paper. They are undocumented. In some ways, you say they're caught in this predicament of unsettlement. That is, you know, continually moving but having no right to move and no right to stay. And so, you know, you say that very beautifully and it comes through. But these are also documents, and these are also documents that maybe partake not just of the logics of the young men, you know, young men and women wanting to show themselves and so on that we spoke of, but they also partake of the logic of anthropology and its interest in the visual, etc., which is a pretty long history, right? And a history of cinema and sort of documentary in that sense. So these are, but they're sort of resisting a little bit the documentary. Maybe there are documents, but not documentary. Or how do you understand these within your own? Maybe I'll ask it two ways. How does the collaboration between you and these three men and others begin, not just as in when did you meet and so on, but when did the idea that the form of getting together turn into a kind of theatricalized presentation of life or a kind of excerpting of daily life and presenting it for others? When did it begin to turn into that and the making of a film? Like, when did that become kind of conscious? And do they see it at all as a document? Is a document even a good word in this, in what we're seeing? Could we even think of it in those ways? Or is there something wrong? And in that case, what would be the preferred? What language would we use to understand these?
That's a very good question, and it's a complicated question. I mean, this is part of a multiplicity of efforts to find a way to describe, learn from, be solidary with, and to communicate something about this world and these experiences. So there are written forms, different kinds of written forms, monographic, essayistic, poetic, and so forth, and then these lie next to a kind of relatively straight documentary form, which was their first ambition. So my work with the people you see here is kind of totally simultaneous with the work on this project. It was a kind of co-conceived idea that we would produce a filmic document. Their understanding of documentary is not what you see here. And in the last piece here, in a little film called A Film Is Being Made, comprised of the outtakes and their conversations about what they're doing while filming underground, conversations about me, about white people, about film. And there's a moment where one of the young men says, you know, this is how it works. You know, there's going to be a white person talking, they're going to explain everything, and you're going to do the interview, show the action. Do the interview, show the action. And they had an incredibly schooled, a very knowing, generically kind of rigorous concept of what is documentary in a particular way. And during the process of their first sojourn underground, before they had seen anything, before I had seen anything, they were shocked by what they saw. I'm talking about the underground stuff now. They were shocked by what they saw.
Themselves?
Yes. They said they couldn't believe it looked so terrifying. It frightened them to see it. And then, of course, they quickly assimilated that. At every step of the process, I take things back, I show them the footage, we talk about it, we talk about translations, we talk about editing decisions. My beautiful editor, Pascal Plutz-Trumel, who was here with his wife and their beautiful 10-day-old baby, of course, and I are responsible for the forms that these take. These are very different than these, which the videos on the panels are indeed intended to be documents of a different sort, more testimonial, not quite direct, nonetheless directed. The method, which I've already described, is one in which we talked for days, in which I tried to communicate my interest in everything, not just in the climax of an event, not just in the production of value, not just in the explosion, but in how you eat and sleep and shit underground and so forth, like the total quotidian experience. And I certainly trained them to use cameras. They produced things I hadn't expected. They made decisions I hadn't expected, and then we worked with that together. These are efforts to, they may succeed or fail. I wanted you to feel that these conversations wouldn't probably have taken place in your absence, in my absence. And yet, they don't depend on you for their truth value. You know, these are conversations that could have been happening for others, and the testimony that they communicate about aspiration, experience, accident, education, full of ironies and wit and so forth, that you feel a bit like you, that it's going on independently of you. Hence the kind of consciousness of the presentation to you, because that presentation precedes the actual moment. I hope they don't look like straight visual anthropological documents. This is not a project of like represent yourself as a member of an ethnographic type. That would be a horrible thing. Of course, there's something about here's a camera. Let it be the medium of your self-expression, but not as representatives of an ethnographic type. The differences of opinion, the arguments about production, The arguments even about how come there's gold left. These are, you know, complicated things. The political disputes, the long conversation about the nature of democratic possibility and what is Zimbabwe now and what is South Africa now and what is social democracy without employment. These are debates that, this is another thing I would have to say, that I wanted so hard for people to have this sense of the incredible intelligence, acuity, knowingness of everyday conversation among people who have been deprived of every opportunity for accessing formal education. The lucidity and the clarity of analysis is, to me, something to learn from. I mean, I learn from these people. So that's another part of the ambition of the...
And this is linked to this question of what we're looking at in terms of documents, because, for example, I think that if you're looking at the film In the Next Room, where you say that whether how the cameras are showing you as you go into the mines and so on, and having the conversations which you talked about. I mean, in some sense, this documents, it shows the daily life of the work in the mines, let's say. It's documenting what they're doing. They're talking about you, about everything that you say. So there's some way in which the document is documenting things as they're happening, as they're unfolding. And yet, as you suggested a while ago, the fact that they're able to be down there has to do with an entire history that preceded their being able to go down there, where these mining companies, where the mining companies made the infrastructure that is now in ruins and so on, so that what you're looking at is not simply a document of what's happening in the moment of the image. You're looking at something that bears the traces of an entire network of historical relations, political issues, economic issues, the history of mining, not just in South Africa, but elsewhere. And I think about this because Emerson at one point says that if you read a sentence properly, it can become as broad as the world. Right? And there's one way, if you read these moments in these videos or in these photographs properly, they can become as broad as the world, right? Because they bear the traces of an entire network of historical, I mean, unforeseeably mediated relations, right? And so this also interrupts the idea that we would have of a document where it documents something that is on the surface. We're almost being invited in a Benjaminian fashion to read what's not visible on the surface, but which nevertheless has left its traces on that surface.
That is beautifully said and absolutely true. I mean, one could indeed say that the kind of rhetorical through line of this entire project is dust, and then part, you know, and one should treat it both in its kind of material specificity as this crystal dust that is going to bury you alive from the inside, all the way down to that kind of residue of the imperial moment that was, you know, I mean, British imperialism was consolidated in South Africa in the 1890s. 42% of the capitalization of the English stock market was invested in gold in South Africa. The French money markets really came into being through investments in the gold mines in South Africa. German financiers really, you know, consolidated themselves through this. And then the entire history of industrial technologies, from the development in the biggest markets for dynamite to the development of the cyanide technologies that, of course, have left their residues
to extract the gold.
I mean, actually, it's, you know, people, of course, there's mercury in it, and it's a terrible thing, and mercury is most dangerous when it's transformed into gas. It's not as dangerous when it's in its semi-liquid form. The horror of this industry is cyanide. I mean, gold in South Africa below 120 feet deep cannot be extracted except with cyanide. It's a strange kind of conglomerate. And I would argue, in fact, that cyanide was more important than dynamite in South Africa. And indeed, these miners speak about how this is actually what differentiates them from industrial miners. They use everything but cyanide, of course, and oxygen and all the rest. But yes, you're absolutely right. So when you say you've worked in one place for 20-some years, not only because these migrants are moving in the entire Southern African region, but because we are, you know, embedded in this incredibly complex set of webs, you know, right up to the moment of the gold in our cell phone, to the fantasy of storable value that continues to hedge financial markets and so forth. This, we are bound in some ways to this world, dependents and beneficiaries of it. And I want that to be visible. But you're correct that reading that sentence about the dust of this world would require, is, you know, a recursive kind of rereading. And I hope some of the wall texts help that.
It's a good moment to open it.
Could you say something about the women who are grinding, please?
The women who are described and whom you see grinding the rock in this particular part of this Southern African scavenging economy, this is done almost exclusively by women. It is the most dangerous part of the job. Going underground is terrible. Things may happen. There may be rock falls. People die all the time. But all of these women are dying all the time because this is gold is bound to a kind of quartz, which is essentially like glass. So as you see, and I wanted you to see, this is why all the slow motion in the second part of Below Ground Above, this grinding by hand, which a certain romanticism sees as the repetition of corn grinding, is the grinding of stone into glass and dust, which is being breathed all the time. I have spoken to women about this. I have, you know, tried very hard to encourage people to do things to ameliorate that risk. And as I'm sure you know, in very desperate circumstances, it's a kind of the temporality of people's calculations. Yes, I will die in so many years, but I will die of starvation sooner. And it's a terrible thing, and it is, to me, an atrocious failure on the part of the mining companies to have left these shafts open, unsealed, the environment unremediated. That would not deal with the fact that this is quartz, but it is indeed women's burden. In this part, there are other places where young men do that work. Always junior, always feminized people do this work because of its postures and its exposures. And it's very painful. Many of these women are unattached. They don't accompany these men. They come on their own. They're quite independent. They may end up attached to men. Many of them have small children. Those children are exposed to that as well. So I don't want, you know, my desire to testify to the heroic courage that these individuals have is not my desire to testify to the virtue of this kind of work, which cannot be avowed in any way, which needs to be replaced with other kinds of work, for sure. And that's a hard thing to separate out, actually, to testify to their courage and invention and labor without making it seem like that's a good way to do things.
David. I'm intrigued by the dust image. It captured my attention because I was just teaching the Epic of Gilgamesh today, and we hear that when people die in the world of Gilgamesh, they go to a horrible basement, and they're transformed into birds, and they eat only dust. And dust seems to be this image of that which gives no life, but also kind of futility. And we think of dust as a worthless subject, substance. But as I'm already starting to see here, right, it also stands for a dispersal and the extraction of value from something very minuscule. And so that was kind of my question. How, in your conversations with these people, do they see the infinitesimal value of the things that they're extracting, because they're looking for these tiny fragments, right, in relation to the enormity of the wealth that exists elsewhere? How do they mark their own value in this world in an enterprise that otherwise seems really quite futile and hopeless?
So they, of course, are driven by need, and they often joke and laugh about the minuscule amounts of gold they're getting. You know, there are scenes underground that I've listened to, you know, where you know, this is shit. These aren't even tenths. These are hundreds of grams, you know. And where they speak also about the scandalously, you know, enormous wealth of other people elsewhere. The figures that they always turn to for that are sports heroes, you know. Cristiano Ronaldo, always mentioned as that guy who walks on cash, sleeps on cash, can make a bed out of cash. But also the mining magnates of Africa, including people like Patrice Motsepe, as well as the Oppenheimers and so forth. So they have a very knowing understanding of relative value, and they speak a lot about it, and they're constantly producing metaphors with which to understand the difference between who has and who has not. That said, these are by and large, these are not people who advocate equality. They are like many people. They advocate equal access to inequality. If, you know, this is also true in the unions and of the formal mines in South Africa. If you ask people, should everyone be paid the same thing? It's like, no way. You know, there should be a calculus in which labor, value, worth, knowledge, age, sex, all of these things in most of their discourses should be recompensed on some calculable scale. I mean, we often talk about it, we disagree about it. So they have many, you know, many idioms, many concept metaphors with which to speak that inequality. I mean, it's a terrible thing of this moment that the only thing worse than being exploited by industrial capital, corporate capital, you know, is not being exploited by it, is being abandoned entirely to the precarious predicament of no wages. When there's no welfare state, no, you know, or you are excluded from that. South Africa has a fairly robust welfare state, but so it's a complex thing. One of the young men actually does strike it rich, or at some point he did. He made 4,500 rand. That's $300, on which he lived for 3 months. But a month later, he didn't have enough to eat. He says that he was so hungry, he sold his hair. He had long, beautiful dreads. You've seen him. So he cut his dreads to sell it. He was promptly in a barroom brawl and stabbed in the face. And so they don't always survive, actually. I mean, they just are not surviving. I mean, the level of hunger, the level of not having is really not to be underestimated. I mean, there's a certain bravado in this self-presentation, and someone has managed to make a 10-foot by 16-foot shack look like a livable space, which maybe it is, but there's often not food.
In this context in which people are just not surviving, why is that they choose not to use cyanide in the mines? And the second question is, could you tell us a little bit about the religious aspect of the document that is portraying behind you? Are those evangelists? And if so, what is their role in this community?
Cyanide, you'd need like very complex industrial processes and enormous vats and things. I mean, this could not be done manually. The way that mercury can be used manually to amalgamate, you couldn't use cyanide that way. Or you would probably die very fast. So that is a marker of full, irreducible industrial process. On this wall, there's a text that translates the rite that is performed at the beginning of the entry to the mines, and that is then performed again. A text so poetically beautiful that it's reproduced here. The evangelical Christianity and various kinds of Zionist Christianity is omnipresent in this world. There's not a moment of a day where there isn't a church service that is going on, walking down the streets, a choir singing. Underground, you often hear men whistling or singing hymns. Most of them have grown up in church circumstances. It saturates the world as a source of metaphysical meaning-making and consolation that is not in any opposition to ancestral belief. I mean, there's no competition between these things. They're both making offerings to the ancestors, both hoping to be rejoined with the ancestors if they die underground, and Christians in this world. But there was actually, I mean, there are also Muslims in this world, and although this specific community doesn't have as large of a Muslim population as, say, some parts of the Cape, it's present. And a couple of years ago, when a young man was killed in a mine and his body was brought up, and we were trying to organize a funeral because he didn't have enough money to have his body transported home, which is the presumptive desire of just about everyone. And we couldn't figure out, you know, who should do the funeral, a group of them and with myself and another woman, Cora Bailey. And Yvette, my partner, contacted people in the Anglican Church. They tried to provide someone. Then we went to evangelicals. The local imam says, well, I'll do it, because he needs a proper burial, so I will just be Christian for the day. I mean, and this is also part of a South African story, eh? This incredible, alongside the xenophobia and hateful racism that, you know, apartheid seems to win again and again and again, is this other fact of an incredible capacity to recognize, be with, learn from, share the commitments, values, and languages of other people is really interestingly present. It's a resource to be used. And I wanted in this piece to do two things. I wanted to make visible the metaphysics of this world and the degree to which people feel themselves to be in the presence of otherness and forces, fortune, luck, fate, favor. But also I wanted to create this parallel world that this piece ends, maybe not where you're expecting, you know, after the sulfurous sliding of the map, there's only descent. And for many of these people, the, you know, God is desired and absent when needed. So I wanted some of that to be communicated in this.
This was such a powerful set of discussions and such a powerful set of images. So I want to thank you, and I'm looking forward to coming back. I guess I want to ask a question about community and rootedness and transience. You spent some time in the beginning talking about how many of the people that we're seeing and that we're listening to are migrants. They're transient. They're coming from one place to another. But at the same time, I'm trying to understand if there's a community that is rooted there, and if so, in what kinds of ways. And as I'm thinking about the mines in particular, I could imagine there would be competition to enter into the mines that might potentially be seen as the most potentially valuable. So I'm wondering what kind of rooted communities you have that are there, even if there are people who are coming and going, and the degree to which there are either religious people who are present, or the equivalent of a union organizer who is present, or actually other kinds of families, because that's that individuation that you were talking about relative to a community that used to be there, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
Okay, I'll try and be brief because I know we're getting short of time, so there are many nested and overlapping communities. People follow the roots of their relations. They get advice. They join a sister, a brother, a cousin, what have you. These become small cliques that are in some proximity to other kind of communities. People tend to work in groups from the same place-ish, the same region, who speak the same language. But there is competition, and there's a great deal of violence, and access to the mines is regulated by security guards appointed by groups of miners themselves who take money or cell phones or some kind of surety, both upon entering and departing, ostensibly in exchange for making sure that other people are not coming in armed. On the other hand, there are armed gangs who go underground, who press gang people, extort, violate, kill people underground, so that happens. When things are working, they're working in a remarkable way. So one team will go underground and say, well, I found a good, you know, line of gold. Well, you work until you're exhausted. And then you cede it to the next person. You're not going to like, you don't get to keep that forever. You get it for a period of time. And then the next team gets to mine that same vein until they're exhausted and need to go up for food or whatever. And then, and there are literally lines, you know? And actually, some of my most embarrassing translation mistakes are about like misrecognizing what line are we talking about. Is this the line of gold? Is this the line to get to the gold? Is this the, and most embarrassingly of all, this is a family named the Lines, who I thought were lines, but they were actually just people.
So how long does someone stay underground typically? Like how long does it?
So lovely young Prosper WhatsApped me yesterday, and he had just been underground for 2 weeks. That's a very long period of time, typically 3 to 5 days. Alas, he was robbed of everything upon leaving the mine. That's that, you know, robbery is common. Organized crime parasitically goes to these areas because it's abandoned by the state. There's no functioning police. There's no, so they are not so much the authors of crime as the victims of that which takes place when the state withdraws itself.
I have a question.
Then there's a question. Okay. I see your hand now.
I have a question about the afterlife of these minds or the presence of these minds in the South African national imaginary today. So that if minds were once the dream object, right, of the South African imaginary, what are they now, and does the Zama Zama project fit into that imaginary?
So, I mean, I think there's an enormously split sense. I mean, on the one hand, a very strong number of, very substantial number of people have no consciousness of how close is the horizon of finitude of this industry. The gold mines have not been the central part of the South African economy since the 1970s, but no one has believed that. I mean, the symbolic function of those mines is enormous, and that persists. But also there are other kinds of mining, you know, the platinum industry has taken up a great deal of the slack of the gold industry and so forth, and union activity has moved there. Zama Zama is, you know, a reviled and disavowed practice, form of life. It is within the dominant discourse in South Africa. I mean, there is some movement to decriminalize it. But the Department of Mineral Resources, I think rightly says, I mean, this is not to be dealt with at the level of criminalization or decriminalization. I mean, no one can be responsible for ensuring the safety of such people. I mean, you can't, a state cannot agree to send those people to their deaths in a way. So, but the supplement that would be needed to repair that, you know, recognition, non-exclusion from education and healthcare, access to safe water, access to housing, access to food, as well as employment. And, you know, it's a terrible thing. I mean, South Africa arrived into its freedom, you know, with this horrible history that had not distributed resources, confronted immediately by an epidemic that eviscerated a generation and cost a fortune. The socialist option had vanished. The neoliberal forces were enormous. And then, of course, there was the garden variety corruption. But the task and the resources were so unfairly available or not available. And now, you know, it's easy to say these people need jobs and access. On the other hand, as Bakani says, even for South Africans, there's not enough. Or that is not true. There is not that is distributed. Like lots.
Hello.
Hi.
The word justice it infuses everything that happens between the developed world and sub-Sahara Africa. I'm wondering, how do you think about that word in relation to your work in this project? The Slout Foundation, it's about justice, and manifesting it and illuminating it. And I'm wondering, how does that word, how is it present here? What are your thoughts regarding your work and justice?
Well, that's a demanding and good question. I mean, I would hope that my work would serve in the pursuit of the kind of understanding that could work toward justice. Now that sounds evasive, but I sort of think of it, Miro Rukeyser saying poetry will not save the world, but it will promote the kind of thought that can save the world. The obligations of the, for lack of a better word at the moment, global north to the impoverished of southern Africa are enormous, not remotely on the horizon as responsibilities to be actualized in concrete ways. The necessary transfer of resources, wealth, and the solidarity with the efforts to redistribute it in southern Africa in a regional, non-nationalist kind of way strike me as absolute imperatives. The question of what justice means for these people is one that I have to cede to them. I mean, I think in different ways the people who speak here and from whom I have tried to learn speak about justice and their aspirations for justice and their understandings of it in quite different and sometimes conflicting ways. So I would not want to appear to be trying to ventriloquize that, but I do feel in a kind of very straightforward way that there is a strong need for the kind of understanding that could come out of an encounter with them through this to turn itself into much more concrete, transformative and transferential kinds of projects. That would not yet be justice. The question of historical justice, the insoluble task of historical justice in this place of just unrelenting injustice is overwhelming, which does not mean that there cannot be gestures made in its pursuit. And I feel that's an inevitably inadequate answer to your question, but that would probably be where I would start. I mean, my first effort would say, let us learn from people.
I like your reference to, did you say transferral?
Yes.
Transference, or what was the
transformation and transferral of resources.
Resources.
And project solidarities, recognition, yes.
Yeah, a thought that comes to mind is how you could facilitate maybe the transfer of value the other way. That is, maybe some South African artists, students, or
yeah,
even the miners, doing research on miners in West Virginia,
right,
et cetera, for instance.
I mean, I do encourage, try to advise, supervise, welcome, solicit students from South Africa and Southern Africa and actually West Africa with whom I've worked with, Angola, Senegal, and so forth, Cameroon, to do work of this sort. I mean, people like you meet in these films, I mean, they can't get a driver's license, never mind a passport, never mind access to education. If they do get education by bribing schools, then the child is not allowed to matriculate because they don't have papers to prove that they were there legitimately. I mean, so two directions. I totally agree with you. The encouragement of a reciprocal kind of mutual understanding and knowledge production is necessary. A recognition of the inaccessibility of this opportunities for these kinds of people. And I would join in and be solidary with people in Southern Africa who are arguing against this nationalist refusal of opportunity and recognition for neighbors who are living amongst people. You know, one of Fani Magwazi says in another film, yeah, you can learn something from a stranger. You might even be able to live with them.